Hello, sweet listeners. Kaffirs here. Before we begin our stimulating and thrilling discussions, I would like to say a few pleasant words about our sponsors. The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication, with articles written by the readers for the readers. It features not only discussions of an academic nature, but also fun, light reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. The BSJ is essential reading for any fan of the great detective, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and fanatical mustache appreciation. The Scintillation of Sion is an annual symposium of fans for Arthur Conan Doyle and his creations. It is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box and Maryland, USA. You can find out more information about the next event at www.scintillation.org. Wessex Press and their imprint, Gastian Books, are premier publishers of Sherlock Holmes-related material. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation of Sherlock Holmes, is an essay collection by online fans. It is edited by several of the Baker Street Babes, with a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. The book will be available for purchase at BSI Weekend and exclusively online at www.wessexpress.com from the 18th of January. On the same day, Christina Menente will be signing copies of the book at the BSI Dealers Room in the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City. The book is 280 pages long and is priced at $24.95.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your. Quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two, one,
ladies, gentlemen, and canonical scholars, welcome to the 51st episode of the Baker Street Babes podcast. We are today talking about the episode His Last Vow of BBC Sherlock, and we feature an all-star cast, as always, Christina Menente, Catherine, Sarah, and then, oh, we have Artie and Amy. Hello. And me, Lindsay Faye. If we sound all a bit shell-shocked in any way, it's because we have watched this episode. So can you blame us?
Yeah, so like the other two before, we're going to go through the episode chronologically, commenting along the way. His Last Vow, wherein we pretty much pick up the can and go, oh look, we're going to put it into an episode of Sherlock. Kapunk.
Yeah, it's like a happy canon blender. Well, not happy.
I didn't think happy was quite the correct word.
Wrong.
But as this episode is mainly based on Charles Augustus Milverton, you all know that I have a lot to say about it.
Milverton. He is our favourite villain.
He is so good.
Everybody's favourite villain, okay.
And played to perfection by Lars Mikkelsen.
Oh, yes.
All right, so to kick stuff off, we are immediately introduced to Charles Augustus Magnusson, going up against Lady Blackwood?
Smallwood.
We are introduced to her, and pretty much that Magnusson has been brought in for an inquiry, because he keeps meeting with the prime ministers, and it's just from the get-go, you know that this version of Milverton is just as much of the snake as he is in the canon. I just think he holds the screen with like this cold, like just intensity, and you're like immediately creeped out. Not to mention when he like licks your face, but
that was cringe. Yeah.
Oh, squirming in my seat. It's like, oh god, I can't even deal with you right now.
I love that they changed it to shark though, right? Shark. Yes. He does the whole shark paragraph where it should be the snakes. But you're like, yeah, sharks are scary. it was very well adapted.
Then we realized that Lady Smallwood wants someone to stand up to Magnusson, and who better than Sherlock Holmes? But we do not get to Sherlock immediately. Instead, we get to a nightmare sequence with John in perhaps not so happy married bliss. And I don't know if, there's a lot of people who are like, can you talk about the fact that John's like having nightmares again? Is it PTSD? And I think it's actually just him like dying of complacency.
I think isn't that exactly what Mycroft said in basically the first episode? He's like, you're not haunted by the war, you miss it, and that's him. Yeah. The dreams are manifesting because he's not doing it. The action isn't there in his life anymore. He's too like domesticated now, and he's obviously, you know, a bit of a mad dog.
Yeah, so which is why he leaps at the chance to go looking for this drugged up kid of his neighbor's.
I mean, I read the TV magazine article that was a little bit spoilery that came out a couple of days before the episode aired. And it said, oh, you know, Cho's back on drugs and John finds him in a drug den. And I was immediately like, oh, twisted lip. Yeah, awesome. Mm-hmm. Because that's all about, you know, I mean, obviously you are listeners of us, so I'm assuming you've read it, but it's all about this exact sequence. Pretty much Watson goes to find the husband of a neighbor who's absconded.
It's the identical name too, Kate Whitney. Same name, they kept it. It was awesome.
Yes, and the husband's called Ira, though, is he not Isaac?
Isa.
Right. So they changed it to Isaac, and they made it the son and not the husband. But still, canon-wise, I was pretty happy with that, and also with the whole way the whole sequence happened, because John got to be badass and sprained.
I was thinking of you at the point in which he like kind of handled the drug dealer, and I was like, I really wish that Ardy was in the room right now, because like my secondhand enjoyment of your enjoyment would have been really good. I was wondering if anybody else thought this, or if this is like too much. Oh, the bit where Jean comes out of the house and gets into the car, and then Mary comes after him and says, you know, he's like, you're not going. Because you're pregnant, and she's like, you're not going because I'm pregnant, and then gets into the car. I wondered if that was directly influenced by the lines from Charles Augustus Milverton, where, you know, Holmes isn't going to kick in, and Watson's like, you know, not without me, you know. So I wondered if they'd like kind of switched that up a bit and given it to Mary instead, which I thought was quite an interesting thing to have done.
Yeah, definitely.
So we meet a new character, which I was very happy about. Wiggins!
Not just Wiggins, though, but Billy as well. Billy the Page and Wiggins, all in one beautiful, homeless, sort of dry package.
So it's pretty much exactly lifted from the Man with the Twisted Lip, and we get to see, for the first time, Sherlock on drugs, which I think was handled very well personally. And I think I'm really glad that they actually went there, because they're always saying, you know what, that's in the past, like they've alluded to it, but they're not going to ever go there, and they actually went there. And I thought that was one, very interesting, and two, like I said, I think it was handled very well.
I had mad respect for it. I have seen some commentary on it, and not only did I think that the actual sort of excuse that he's using in the addict's mind, sort of like, oh, yes, I have to do this for a case, but, you know, just a little bit, I'll be fine. I've quit before, I'll be fine. Like, I thought it was extremely realistically handled. I thought it was very, very well played by Cumberbatch. But also, I've seen some criticism about John initially, sort of like his instant reaction is like, you're back on drugs, you're taking a piss test, this is happening right now. And it's like, are you expecting him not to behave in a super concerned fashion? And I'm not saying he did it wrong or right, but an angry reaction to finding Sherlock Holmes in these circumstances is, I think, deeply understandable in terms of like character motivation and where he's coming from. And the families and loved ones of people who are dealing with drug addiction don't always handle it well, and they don't always handle it diplomatically. And I thought that it was extremely well written that Molly doesn't handle it well. John doesn't handle it well. Nobody handles it well. Mycroft doesn't handle it well. And everything is just sort of, you know, turned into this spiral of what have you done with yourself? But that is a very fair reaction in terms of portraying reality, I think.
No, absolutely, because it comes from a place of love and concern.
Exactly.
For me, it really comes back to that glimpse of it that we saw in series 2 with the Danger Knight. So it all comes back to, you know, John and Mycroft have dealt with like this situation being about to happen, and you know, being protective and reining it in, and, you know, all sorts of headcanon going on there. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's actually happening now, of course, you know, of course they're going to be angry. Of course somebody's going to smack him in the face. And I, for one, was really glad that it was Molly, because he's had that one coming for a long time and for a lot of things that he's done for her. That part of the episode I just really appreciate.
She had some extra arm power saved up.
She did. What I was going to say is, I thought that Molly, that particular scene where Molly, like, just smacks him around the face was probably one of my favorite pieces of character development for anybody in the whole episode. Like, that Molly has come so far from the first episode, like, up until now, in terms of her, like, relationship with John, Sherlock, and obviously with all the other characters as well. And that she was able not only to stand up to him, but also to say, like, how dare you do this? You know,
and she was saying what everyone is thinking, which is to do with his brain, don't you think?
Yeah, looking after his brain. You know, he's been given a beautiful gift. You know, why would he waste it in such a way? And it was just fantastic. And the other thing was, what was it? It's just slipped my mind now. Oh, yeah, the interesting thing that I thought as well is when Sherlock attacks Mycroft and John says to him, you know, you need to leave immediately because he will hurt you. Now, my thought was, like, did John know that because he has actually seen Sherlock on drugs before, because he just knows what people on drugs are like? I don't know what the implication of that particular scene was.
Well, he does have experience dealing with, you know, his sister when she's off her face.
True.
So so when it comes to substance abuse, he absolutely knows, like, that somebody can go off the deep end, maybe in an emotionally charged situation like that very quickly. However, I don't know if it was necessarily, like, a reaction to something he's seen with Sherlock before.
Yeah, I thought it was just more of an appraisal of Sherlock. And what he would predict Sherlock would be likely to do in that situation. I'm kind of agnostic on whether he's seen it before in reality or not.
He's a doctor. He would have seen it before.
As well, like what Lindsay said about Harry as well, I thought that's, like, a really interesting point to make. He has direct experience of substance abuse.
And because there's also, like, the implication, like, do you think this is a danger night? Which means there's been nights like that before.
Yeah.
So maybe he hasn't seen him, like, quite like this, but I think under any circumstances that Sherlock physically just attacks his brother. So it's like, okay, so we need to dissolve the situation, and probably the best way to do that is for you to leave.
Yeah. Because he's
that was more continuity, actually, than I was expecting, to be honest with you, because, like, when John is like, yeah, no, I called him. That's why he's here. I called him.
Yeah.
Of course I called him. But, like, that makes a lot of sense, as opposed to, you know, they could have made up any number of scenarios there, and that harks directly back to season two, which was cool.
After that, they've been teasing about, like, the whole, like, bathtub scene for ages, but it turns out we don't actually get to see inside the bathroom, but Sherlock's having a bath.
Somebody does, though.
Somebody does. And when Janine stepped out, my jaw just dropped, and I was like, oh my god, they're going here. This is awesome.
Agatha.
Agatha, Janine as Agatha from the original case.
And they did it better than Granada. I'm just gonna put it out there. I love that episode of Granada, but that aspect of it, BBC Sherlock for the win.
Amy, you could not be more correct about that. Winning.
I could just hear Tumblr melting in the distance.
What I just love about that entire scene is that Janine is obviously, you know, Sherlock says in love, but I don't know necessarily in love, but definitely, you know, attached and sort of loving it, and, like, she's, like, rearranged some things in the flat, and it's just, it's so funny because it's so, like, un-Sherlock what Sherlock is actually doing, so you know as the viewer that he's playing her, and if you read the canon, you know exactly what's happening.
Oh, the minute he closes the door
and his face just falls,
the face, and you're just like, oh god, you've done this hundreds of times, but, like, it's so perfect because it's not only in character for the BBC, you know, version of him. But I think that, you know, they're sort of, we're playing off of each other and using each other relationship in the canon. It's not that far off. I mean, Watson's appalled, and he's rightly appalled, and he should be appalled that, like, Holmes managed to get himself engaged to, you know, break into a house. But Holmes insists that he has a hated rival and that she is actually just, you know, sort of using him as a contrasting element to get the other guy to, you know, put up or shut up. So the way that they ended up doing it was taking that kind of verbatim, which I thought was, like, it was very cool.
No, definitely. And just John's face, that entire sequence, even after when Sherlock is trying to be like, Charles Augustus Magnuson, and his face, he's like, what? I don't understand what I just saw.
If Martin Freeman's head could have fallen off during that sequence, he would have just let it fall off.
So from there, we get a visit from Charles Augustus Magnuson.
Oh, God.
Doesn't leave his card this time, which I thought was very rude.
That was one rude thing. If we're counting, there are moments that stand out, as John put it. Yes.
I mean, what kind of struck me most about this version of Milverton was sort of, because they played up this whole kind of disregard for any kind of social or personal boundaries. And for people who've been watching Sherlock for a long time, you know, we're used to somebody who violates people's boundaries all the time, but that was like a whole other level. So I was just kind of watching it going, yeah, they did that so well, because with Moriarty, he's kind of meant to be the mirror image, and it kind of works in the BBC version, but not really. But with Milverton, you just kind of get the feeling that, yeah, wow, he's just on a whole other planet.
Totally. I think we talked about this in our Milverton appreciation episode, right? Where we were just talking about how this guy, like, far from appreciating him, Moriarty, there's always this sense of, oh, hail fellow, well met. I could have had a criminal enterprise if I'd really applied myself, you know? Where Sherlock's almost kind of like, yeah, that would have been a neat way to go. Oh, whoops, I have to defeat him now. Whatever. All right, I'll go to this waterfall. But like with Milverton, he's disgusted the entire time. He's just like so revolted by that villain. And you never get that sense of revulsion with Moriarty. And I loved how they incorporated it into this episode, because it was like the viewer is likewise disgusted by this character.
Yeah, yeah. And what's so interesting is it's something that Sherlock says later to Mycroft, that the reason he hates Magnuson so much is because he picks on people because they're different, which obviously harks back to Sherlock really intensely.
Mm-hmm.
And just because Magnuson, he's such a bully. He's just such a bully throughout this entire episode. And it's like, oh.
Because before we were talking about the shark reference, but there was something about him that just reminded me of like a lion as well. It was almost like the scene where he like pees in the fireplace. It was like he was marking like his territory and being like, you know, y'all bitches belong to me. And but that was kind of what I was going through in my mind, because he kind of treated everybody else's personal space as an extension of everything that he owned.
Yeah, you know, I feel like when you read the story in canon, there's this underlying sense of just absolute revulsion. And I have to say, I honestly didn't even expect that they would be able to translate that to screen as perfectly as they did.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the feeling of reading the story and watching that are the same whenever he's on screen. It's just that ultimate, like, almost unwatchably nasty person.
100%, and they kept the creepy little glasses. That was such a great canon nod. Like his little round, you know, rimless glasses where you're just like, ugh. What? And like, I love glasses like that. On regular people, they're adorable. But on Milverton, you're like, no.
The whole thing with the glasses, obviously, we'll come back to later, but it was really interesting how at the beginning of the episode, I was like, oh, that's such a cheap, like, technology trick. And then obviously it isn't.
Yeah, I felt real dumb.
I thought it was his mind palace at the beginning. I actually did. And then they kind of red herringed me in the middle, but I at the beginning thought that's where they were going, and then they kind of faked me out like toward halfway through.
Oh, see, I'm just not that smart.
I wondered if they were going there, but I kind of like, I figured that they wanted to do like as little mirroring of Sherlock Holmes with Milverton. Excuse me, Magnuson. We're all doing that, by the way, and I think it's actually really cute. That we can't get the name right from the BBC episode because we're so stuck in the canon. I thought they were going to want to not mirror Sherlock to the extent that they both have this sort of capacity. So that was where I was faked out. But yeah, I get that, Amy.
Good. All right, so then we have the break-in. Which slightly disappointed there were no masks, but I'll let it slide. The best part of it, I swear to God, was the proposal. Giant puppy dog eyes. It just like, and it was funny, cause watching at the BAFTA and just like the gasp that came out of the audience.
Like, I know it's a canon reference and I can read it as a canon reference, but it does not work for me on any other level other than that.
Sherlock Holmes can be rough sauce, dude.
I mean, you know, if somebody proposes marriage to me after going out with me for like a month or however long it was, I, you know, not do what she did, but okay.
Everyone's different.
Well, but if she was also playing him, which we'll get to, it that kind of, to me, explained why I think the fail there is that he is him not maybe tracking that, or maybe he did track that she was using him too. So there was kind of, I don't know, I thought they were kind of both coming at it from a weird angle there.
There's a secondary level of fail in addition to that, though, Amy, don't you think? Because she says when she's leaving the hospital room, she's like, you know, we could have been bros. Like, there's no reason to pull this crap.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good thing. I thought that was a really excellent line to have put in as well, because it really like put Sherlock in his place. It was like, mm-hmm. you know, if they had been friends, like she might just have let him in anyway. He might have explained, you know, I need to come in for a case. Do you mind doing me a solid? And she might have said yes.
Well, apparently she's getting flicked in the eye constantly, so there's no reason for her not to let him in.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So, getting back on topic.
Yeah.
So they get into the office because of the proposal. And when they get up there, oh no, someone else is there. And they hit her on the head. But I was like, oh no, poor Janine, she's fine. My favorite bit was that John checked one of the security guards, and Chuck's like, don't mind with him, he's a white supremacist. Who fucking cares if he's alive or not?
Yeah, no, that was very Sherlock.
Was that a Five Orange Pips reference with the tattoo?
Yeah. Probably,
I haven't read it in a while.
So. Yes.
Also, though, with the five little dots, if that's a Five Orange Pips reference to white supremacism, that's not like a tattoo that also has, you know, like cultural cred in addition, and we just don't know about it, is it?
I think it can be formed into a swastika or something. Like, it's a really subtle way of having a.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. I've seen it on a list of prison tattoos because I'm weird that way. I actually did.
God, Amy.
I looked for a gallery of them at one point, and I didn't know
undiscovered
if any
depths
of them were
about
true,
you.
But it was on there. Oh, yeah.
So, Sherlock hears something upstairs. He decides to go investigate. And finds a Magnuson cowering and blubbering, just like he does in the canon, with a woman with a gun to his head.
God, as soon as like John says that's Mary's perfume, I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Claire de la Lune. Was still kind of shocking when she turned around. I was like, oh God. And I liked the fact that she was, well, naturally dressed in all black because she was being all covert and stuff. But sort of like that also plays off the canonical, the woman in the black veil.
Totally. Yes. Sort of thing. I had one issue with that, which was kind of like, okay, you've just written this like amazing character. Apparently she's a ninja. Apparently she's all these, you know, things that Sherlock Holmes is also, except that she was, you know, CIA assassin, blah, blah, blah. Then she went freelance, and you get all of the, you get the voyeuristic aspects, right, from Magnuson sort of looking at it. But I could have used a little backstory on her, to be honest with you.
I think we'll probably get it in series 4.
I think it's saved.
Yeah, no, just that scene, the confrontation between Mary and Sherlock. I think that was when, like, my heart started racing and it didn't actually stop for the entire episode.
Oh, yes.
Where he's like, oh, no, you won't hurt me. Damn, girl.
Like, oh, nope, you did.
Basically, like, last time we talked about the Mind Palace, I was talking about how different parts of Sherlock's mind were obviously representative of things like his superego and his ego. But something else that I read, a commentary that someone else had written about it, it was that these different characters are now kind of appearing in his mind palace like avatars for certain kinds of facts.
Yeah.
So Molly has become such a significant part of his life that she has now become his avatar for medical knowledge. And even Anderson appeared in there as well, because obviously he's a forensic scientist. So he sort of popped up a little bit. And I wonder if Sherlock in his mind palace now, because he's formed all these human connections, is now using these people to help him remember certain things. They kind of are the avatars for those certain facts. Like obviously Mycroft is still the very like logical facts, mm-hmm. whereas Molly is like, okay, medical stuff, and then Anderson sort of pops in at the end as well. And I thought that was
that's great. And also, like, you have this sort of aspect where in order for something to be vivid and memorable in the method of loci, you don't have to like it. So Anderson can be there, you know?
Yeah, actually.
It's perfectly fine. It just has to be vivid. You don't have to be fond of that, you know?
That beard is pretty vivid.
I actually have an issue with the whole kind of concept of the sequences that are like that, because I was happy with white on-screen text, and I get that they were like experimenting with doing something new, and I get that they are obviously trying to make the Mind Palace into something more than the one-off gag that it was in Hounds. But I'm afraid it doesn't really work for me. And especially,
you didn't like that sequence? White letters.
I miss the white letters too. I miss the white letters. And also, Artie, you're right in the sense that like you're watching Hounds of Baskerville and you're like, am I watching Hounds of Baskerville or Minority Report? And like, why am I watching Minority Report? And then they just had to take it further.
And then it's over, you know? Yeah. And now it's like this whole big concept.
I think because a lot of it was very foreshadowy, because it's obviously like foreshadowing the fact that we were fooled into thinking that Magnuson's like room was a real place, because we you know, and then it kind of made that more believable because we'd already seen so much detail of Sherlock's sort of mind palace.
That wouldn't have been as effective if we didn't have more exploration of the mind palace.
Can I make a comment? That sequence works for me because that's kind of how my brain works. I would be more likely to see images than I would be to see text in my own brain. I do, like, memory-wise, I have kind of a weirdly good memory of, like, past things that have happened to me. And when I'm in situations, my brain is like a Rolodex, and it goes through related situations that have had similar feelings. And so that particular thing really resonated with me, like, when we see Redbeard and different things happening there. Resonated with me on a personal level, but I also wanted to say, I think if there was any issue with that sequence and other sequences, this is a personal opinion, but the directing of this episode was not my favorite, and I feel like another director might have been able to make that Mind Palace sequence a little bit clearer so that it was a little bit less disorienting.
See, I think I liked it that it was disorienting because he was dying, so it was going everywhere because he was trying to get to all the different facts. Like parts of like his body that were dying, which is I think why we end up in that padded room, because it's the only part left.
Okay, two things on that. But the padded room, I mean, people have been talking about that to really great effect and like doing a lot of commentary on it. But two things. First of all, I'm just going to be honest here. I was too riveted by Cumberbatch's acting skills with a Z to even care about the directing during that sequence, because, you know, like, yes, it was disjointed, and yes, it was kind of like, oh, I'm disoriented and I don't really know where I am, and I'm just like looking at Benedict Cumberbatch going, what are you doing? Because it is awesome. And second, to what extent do any of you agree with the theory that someone's posited, and I wish I could remember the name, but this is on Tumblr, that the padlocked, you know, sort of straight-jacketed Jim Moriarty is actually his heart, because that's what restarts his heart. Like, he gets into this particular room that's locked down, which fits in with all characterizations of Sherlock Holmes. I don't care which, you know, incarnation of him you are. I don't care which actor you are. The emotional aspect is he's got it under lock and key. So he gets into this particular place, his heart stops, And then Jim Moriarty is like, oh, John Watson's in danger. And he forces his heart to start beating again. And it has led people, and I think it's actually a really interesting theory, to posit that that part of his mind palace is just where he's keeping emotion, but he associates it with Jim Moriarty, which is his biggest fear, as you learn in the hallucination at the end of Hounds of Baskerville, because I'm kind of extrapolating this further than it's been taken, but anyway, at the end of Hounds of Baskerville, he's like, no, not you, not yet, which implies that when he is subjected to the drug, that is actually a really terrifying vision, is for him to see Jim Moriarty there out of context. But you see in this, you know, Mind Palace sequence, this is where he's keeping things that are the most important to him. I thought that that was a really interesting choice. I don't know if it was deliberate, but...
That is very interesting. I think one of the elements about Jim Moriarty that I quite like in this is that he is incredibly unpredictable, and I think maybe that is why Sherlock has that fear of him, because he, you know, he can predict a lot of people and a lot of things that people will do, but right up until the end, you know, Moriarty like kind of kept doing things that he didn't expect, and you know, he fears emotion because he can't control it, like he can't control his feelings of fear for Moriarty. He can't control his emotions, so he has to keep them locked away, and he keeps them locked away together.
Yeah. And straitjacketed.
Yeah, straitjacketed, yeah.
And chained.
Yeah. No, I really like that. It's a really interesting theory. Actually, I'd not come across that one.
I came across that one earlier, and I think it's really interesting, and if it's not intentional, that's fine, but I think it has some ground. And just Andrew's acting in that scene was insane.
Oh, amazing. God. He's so good. To whatever extent they're going to use him in the next season, I'm just applauding it. Like, you know, it's not going to be to the extent that we'd like, but it's, you know, however he's used, it's going to be awesome.
Oh, so really something interesting that I just saw on Twitter a little while ago, that the stairs that Sherlock is sort of climbing up and, like, pulling himself up are the same ones from Lauriston Gardens.
Yes,
they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is, I personally love all the Mind Palace sequences that we've got. I am, like, completely, like, indulged in them, so
I thought that was really nice. I like them all but the Hounds one, actually. I think the Hounds one's cheesy. I think the rest of them are cool.
It's the bit where he's listening to the hound dog, and you're just like, why would you keep that, Sherlock? Why was that necessary?
delete, dude.
No, it's really important information. I don't know what you're talking about. something also to mention that we find out who Redbeard is, and I think one of the saddest pieces of dialogue in this entire episode is that when Sherlock has Redbeard, he's like, don't worry, boy, they're putting me down too. Oh, and I was like,
there was a lot of mini Sherlock trauma.
Yeah, the little lock.
Little lock. Oh.
Props to Stephen Moffat's son for being Sherlock.
Yeah, that was adorable.
I think he did a good job.
Yeah. He did. He was super, super good, I thought.
Good.
I think that what was interesting about that as well is it gave us a little bit of insight into a bit of Mycroft's psyche as well, that he still sees Sherlock as that little child.
Yeah. Which I think is something that all older siblings can sort of relate to.
Mm.
Sherlock flatlines, oops, but comes back to life once he realizes that John Watson is in danger, or rather his heart starts again. And we are greeted to Janine visiting him in the hospital, which we were talking about before with all of the papers. Ended up, she's gotten a lot of money out of this deal, so she's quite happy about that. But she's obviously very pissed at him, rightfully so. She sort of got her deal out of it as well, including a cottage in Sussex Downs.
But she's getting rid of the bee.
Yeah, like, that is not okay, That is not okay that she got that cottage.
I think it was hilarious. And the fact when she's like, get rid of the bees, and, like, obviously Sherlock's, like, bringing his thing up, so he's, like, in pain, but it's, like, he's immediately reacting, like, no, don't get rid of the bees.
There's not enough morphine in the entire world to solve the problem that you got rid of the bees. So she's, you know, being very forthright about how angry she is, and, yeah, I took your morphine down. He's like, nah, let's crank it back. And then there's this moment where he's like, oh, there's too much of importance riding on this. And then he, you know, takes it back down again, which I thought was actually a really cool character moment, because as much as he screwed up like half an hour ago in the episode, he's determined not to do that again. I mean, he's even developing in the middle of the episode, which is definitely not the Sherlock that we saw in season one and season two.
Oh, yes,
really.
For sure.
So we get a brief scene with John being very relieved that Sherlock's pulled through, and Mary coming up, and he's like, oh, you heard picture. She's like, why?
That was a super good Amanda Abington impression, Chris.
And of course, the first words that he said when he woke up was Mary. But he decides that he needs to figure out how to work around this. So of course he escapes, and we get the really interesting bolt holes sequence with everyone trying to be like, okay, so where has Sherlock escaped to?
The bolt holes, I love it. I love they brought that in, and they end up with the right canonical number because he has 6, and then they say at first he has 3, and he doesn't have 3, and I'm listening, I'm like, bolt holes, oh my god, bolt holes, and then I'm like, it's not 3, he has more! And then Mycroft says 5, and then Molly's like, yeah, and my house, and I'm like, yes! 6!
So we go back to 2-2 and Beez are trying to figure out where Sherlock is, and John realizes that his chair is back. And just like that, just the realization of when he sees the perfume bottle, when like they're debating, like, why is he trying to protect is he trying to protect his shooter? Is he trying to protect someone else? And just like the realization as it dawns upon him and then Sherlock calls was just heartbreaking.
I know.
Yeah, I think beyond anything else in that episode, if you haven't got it by now, John Watson, that you're important to this dude, well, you know, who would he bother protecting? Oh, my chair. Oh, perfume. Huh. A phone call. Weird. Yeah, it's really subtly played, super well done, and then John turns into the wax bust from the empty house.
Now, yeah,
I'd really like to say some things about Amanda's acting in this whole part, because there is a moment where she goes from being Mary Watson to the assassin, and it's a moment where her face, if you watch really carefully in some of the scenes, goes completely dead, and she does this little bird tilt with her head. It's really interesting to watch. She just goes from like being this quite warm character to just having nothing in her face, and she just tilts her head the way that like a predatorial bird would. And I found it like quite chilling, actually. It was very, very subtle. It happened a lot in the background when they were talking, but especially when they were talking about her past being very dodgy.
Also, you're right, Catherine. I hadn't even thought about that. But also when she's interviewing Anderson and Wiggins a bit.
Yes.
Yeah. You get that steely eye.
Yeah, you can see it, like the way her face just totally changes. And it was some really fantastic subtle like acting that she did there that I was like, ooh. She was a bad girl.
Well, I'm assuming I'm not the only one who sees a Moran parallel there, that I could, thinking back to Hearst, I could see why we had a very different character there. And obviously we don't know what is going to happen with Mary ongoing yet. But her sort of past, though, as Lindsay said, we didn't get a huge amount of it, that whole sequence was very empty house, and I felt like what was being said there was extremely empty house. And even her sort of physicality, the way she was dressed, everything was just very, very Moran to me right there.
Oh, Amy, totally. She's the old Shikari. She's the sharpshooter, like, right there. And John is the wax bust, and she's the sharpshooter. Like, who saw that coming? That was amazing.
Yeah, because the fact is that Sherlock tests her, and she's obviously crack shot. And, you know, that was so... Because I think, like, when was it, like, in some episode, but we were talking about, like, how cool would it be if Mary was Moran.
Yes.
And I guess were we that cool?
We were that cool. I know we talked about this. And so I'm really kind of excited that it happened. But it's very, very complicated character stuff. That we can.
It seems, though, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems from what we've seen so far that her past connections don't directly link to Jim Moriarty in any way. Like, the Moran tropes are all there. All the tropes are there. And so the signs and signifiers, and like, we have all of them, but we don't have any indication from her that she was ever associated with him.
No, no, we don't.
Okay.
Can we just have a moment of appreciation for John Watson's ruffled Sherlock hair?
Yeah, and can. Turned up you can have a long moment of silence for it. It was beautiful.
That whole sequence, though, as soon as like Sherlock stepped out, and then you realize, like, at first I thought it was just a dummy.
Yeah.
But when he went to turn the lights, I'm like, oh my god, no. Mm-hmm. And just Martin Freeman's acting in this entire episode has been very interesting. In the moments where he's just very emotionally and morally conflicted, I think he shined the brightest, especially in this scene where they sort of have that standoff and the really beautifully shot, actually, of the three of them in that narrow hallway.
I would really like to go back and rewatch the episodes now, knowing like what we do about Mary, and sort of watch certain things that she does. Like when they go back to the flat, she immediately walks to the back of the room so that her back is to the wall, and so she can see both of them and what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it would be really interesting if she ever does any kind of things like that in other episodes.
There's something about Mary.
Yeah. There is.
Because, like, Sherlock does sort of, like, rehash, and he goes back, you know, the skip code thing, remembering, like, the specific number of the room, like, all these sorts of things. And we find out that, she stole the identity of Mary Morstan, and that her real name is Bethel Agra, but that's jumping ahead, actually, because we do a time jump to Christmas with the Holmeses.
Oh my god.
I've heard some people say that time sequence was a bit confusing, and I do feel like that might have been a directorial thing. Like, honestly, yeah. I got it, but at the same time I was like, like, why is it going in this order? This is a weird order.
I thought that was quite strange as well. I thought that the narrative had been cut in an unnecessary way, like it had jumped in a not a very fluid way. Obviously, they were doing a bit of experimentation, but I think maybe that could have been left.
It's actually an issue that I have with the whole of the second half of this episode.
Yeah.
It's just impossible to follow, and it kind of is unnecessarily convoluted so that you lose the plot, and that actually disguises the fact that there isn't one.
Yes, there is. So
not that much, and I know I'm being very unkind.
Arty, though, not more than there is in the canon. All they do is rob a house.
Yeah, but still, it's just, I don't know, the whole of the second half of this episode, like, it, you know, flows a bit unevenly, and kind of halfway through I got to the point where I sort of thought, I think we're at the point where this show could really benefit from a different format, because 60 minutes of that would have been okay, and 90 minutes was a bit much.
Hmm.
I was okay with the back and forth just because of the fact that we had sort of been introduced already to these alternate realities to do with the Mind Palace sequences, but then I wonder if the director from The Sign of Three had directed this episode, to be honest with you.
It's a different director.
Right, so I feel like, no, that's what I mean. I mean that the Sign of Three could have been so confusing. It could have been so confusing easily.
Gotcha.
And I feel like this one was actually a bit confusing. And I'm curious, like, if it had been in, you know, like, if certain different choices had been made. I don't know. I have never obviously directed television, but it was a bit confusing in ways that Sign of Three should have been, but it wasn't. Does that make sense?
I agree.
Yeah, that does make sense.
I agree with that.
I just kept thinking of Paul McGuigan. Like, if I say it three times in my head, will he suddenly have been the director of this episode?
I guess maybe I'm in the minority that I kind of like these jumps, but I think that's just me.
They work on a reviewing, I think. I don't think they work on viewing particularly well.
Yeah.
Like, reviewing, you're like, sure, of course, yep.
I guess for me, it's like they're like, oh, this is a really suspenseful moment, and we're gonna switch to something else, so it keeps you like really invested. I guess is how I reacted to it, because I'm like, okay, so in order to find out what actually happens in the scene, something's happening here. But I guess that's just me. I don't know. But what I did think was really interesting is that we find out that it's Mummy Holmes that is the genius of the parents. Which I thought was really nice.
That was great. That was nice.
Yes. Well, I was going to say that this Moriarty is not a professor, a mathematician, but now with Mummy, we have a math professor whose major published work is actually more physics focused than pure math. So I thought that was interesting.
And has pretty much the same title as his masterwork, by the way, minus one word.
It's interesting, like, the comments that you've been sort of getting on, like, Tumblr and Twitter about the whole, like, her leaving work to look after the children. And Yukai kind of got the sense from the episode that Daddy Holmes kind of didn't really have much of a choice in that, like, she's the one who, like, calls the shots. but also, like, if you had two children like Mycroft and Sherlock, would you leave them home by themselves?
No.
I think there's also, there's no shame in women who decide they want to be stay-at-home moms.
There was a little bit of a personal thing in this because my mom left the stock exchange so she could stay at home and like look after us. So, you know, that.
Yeah, my mom.
My mom too.
I also am curious though, to what extent like is he lying? Because if we've learned one thing from watching House and BBC Sherlock, everyone lies. So that was for Artie. That was for Artie.
Yes, I very much appreciate this, Lindsay. Thank you.
You're welcome. To what extent is, like, you know, Papa Holmes kind of, like, just playing dumb? Like, he could whip out an AK-47 in a future episode, and I would be completely unsurprised.
Yeah, are there really any idiots in this family? I don't think so. I mean, she probably wouldn't have married if she was all that stupid.
Sherlock saying in the previous episode that she understands very little, that was, like, super hilarious once we find out this about her.
Yeah, that's just Sherlock being a petulant child.
Exactly.
Maybe because she, like, understands a lot and he's a bit kind of like, meh, 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 meh.
I think that's much more likely. Mary is super preggers at this point. And because I'm thinking, because there's like some people are like, shouldn't she have already had the baby now? I'm like, well, no, not really. Because if she found out she was pregnant in May, then she probably got pregnant like the month before. So she'd be kind of due in January. So.
Yes.
Yeah, that all makes sense.
Yes. Just clearing that up.
Also frightening, but you know.
Yeah, God, I know.
God.
This is when John takes out the USB stick that has Agra on it. And I was like, ah, Agra, ah. That made me happy. Sign of four. So ah. Good. And then that's when they jump back to 221B to get the explanation of Agra. And this entire scene it concentrates on John. This sort of, like, interesting, like, psychoanalysis of John's character, because he completely explodes, you know, kicks the chair. It's like, why is everything always my fault?
Why? You don't see him lose it like that apart from in Baskerville when he's actually just, you know, drugged. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very interesting. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, because there's, like, been some commentary about how, you know, John's too emotionally, like, constipated in this episode. But I think what you just said is, like, we don't really see him lose it that often because he's a soldier, he's contained. And so it's just when he was, like, really, really scared, or in this case he feels incredibly betrayed and angry and hurt and confused, that he just loses it.
Well, you see it during the best man speech. That's it, essentially. Like,
yeah. I thought it was really interesting, just Sherlock quite calmly, probably mostly because he's like, oh dear, I think I'm internally bleeding. But mostly like, okay, so we need to fix this. This is the way I know how to fix it. We should do it this way. So Mary becomes the client.
I was talking to you about this. It's like, hold on, I'm going to fix your marriage real quick. And then just once I fix your marriage, I just need to go to the hospital. Also super quick. Don't worry about it.
I just wanted to say I love how, in my opinion at least, it seems like the fact that she shot him is basically irrelevant to him. Like, he's completely moved on from this. He's like, this is the problem, this is the issue, I understand why she did it, technically I like her, so I'm cool with it. Like, I mean, and we'll get to kind of the end of the episode, obviously, and what decisions he makes, but I feel like it really highlights the idea that Sherlock Holmes has an internal view of justice and how it relates to his opinion of people's worth and what they have in general to bring to the world. And, you know, kind of him before saying the best man he ever knew was the this murderer in Sign of Three. Like, he looks at sort of goodness and badness as kind of stacked up the good things you've done and the bad things you've done. And I think it's interesting that he appraises Mary as good. And so he, you know, he's willing to forgive or overlook or not even consider the fact that she's done this versus how he looks at someone like Magnuson. I just found that really, that contrast really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's really good that you brought up as well. That was almost like a little bit of foreshadowing actually in the Sign of Three, like how he talks about the grotta and how he was like, you know, the best man. And like, it does give you a lot of insight.
We didn't really talk about it last time, I don't think, but that's it's sort of a semi-riffed quote off of the best man I ever knew was he was a complete recluse, and he said that he was, you know, like the most unsociable man ever to happen, but he gave millions of dollars to the London poor, and the most charming woman he ever knew poisoned little children for their insurance money. Yeah. So... that's that bit, kind of, where he's like, no, I'm the decider. I get to pick whether I think that you are moral or not. And with Mary, I think that his decision, it seems like, in this, you know, universe, is based on the fact that she would clearly prefer to protect her relationship with John Watson and prefer to protect John Watson from harm than anything else. And he's like, oh, our priorities line up pretty well.
Yep.
Yeah, because I think the reason that eventually that she says, like, she decides that she has to shoot Sherlock is because John is there. Mm-hmm. And she's like, okay, well, I can't kill Magnuson because if I kill Magnuson, I do have to kill Sherlock and John will be implicated. So she needed, as Sherlock explains, she needed time to reevaluate what she had to do. So she injured him. Unfortunately, he did end up kind of dying, but...
Yeah, that's the bit where she could have done a slightly better job.
Slightly better job, but, yeah, where you go. And then she just sort of pistol whips Magnuson and skedaddles.
When it comes to screenwriting, though, honestly, I think that there's, you know, been some criticism of the character of Mary where it's like, no, you killed him. Like, bad job. Like... if you actually were intending not to kill him, you could have done way better than you actually did. And I get that completely, but, like, honestly, this sounds to me like an incident of screenwriting kind of taking over, and it's like, what if Sherlock was dying? And what if we had a Mind Palace sequence? And what if it was amazing? And then, you know, it's like this character... the attributions, they all sort of line up, but then, you know, you can question it and there are layers of gray in it simply because of the fact that, like, the screenwriters are like, well, yeah, we'd like Mary to want to spare Sherlock's life, and we'd like her to save Sherlock's life by calling the ambulance, but we'd also really like this super cool Mind Palace sequence, so let's kill him.
Yeah, I do agree with that assessment, and that's one of my issues with the episode. It's a bit self-indulgent.
I like being indulged, frankly.
I agree with Artie when it comes to screenwriting in terms of making the story hold together. I like the Mind Palace sequence that happens tremendously in terms of him trying to, you know, save himself. But as far as, you know, Artie's point goes, I do feel like it's a valid criticism of the structure.
Oh, I'm not saying it's not valid.
So. Yeah, I think it's because the episode is so deliberately stylistic that it is... going to be difficult to please everybody with it, because obviously, like, they are using a new director and experimenting with new things. It's not always going to be like 100% for everybody, but, like, it's okay if you, like, really enjoyed that, then, like, it's fine, it's no problem.
I just for the record, super enjoyed all the instances of Martin Freeman just acting as Sola, and also John Watson being badass doctor and spraining people's arms. And
oh, well, exactly. Yeah.
Totally.
We would take all our own enjoyments. There was something in there for everyone.
Yes, yeah. We were talking about John Watson earlier, weren't we? Getting back on topic.
Yes. Yeah,
yes. The line of she wasn't supposed to be like that.
Yes.
Stab in the heart, one. And two, it just goes along with that whole, like, psychoanalysis thing, that John looks for danger now. that he can't live without it, and that harks back to, you know, at the beginning of the episode when, you know, he decides to, you know, jump in a crack den. And just that eventually, like, because I do think it was completely coincidental that John and Mary met and fell in love. I do think mm-hmm. that was coincidental. I don't think there's some masterly plot behind it.
But also, in a sense, you could also say that Mary maybe sensed there was a bit of danger in John as well, and she was also mm-hmm. attracted to that.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Whether subconsciously or consciously.
When the first reveal first happened, I wondered for a few seconds, you know, is she just going to turn out to be a completely evil character? But I quickly realized and thought that it was an honest situation. It was an honest situation that she had fallen for John, which I really liked that they went that route rather than being like, ooh, she's, you know, the big bad or whatever.
Yeah, because that would have been so easy to do, but they made it more morally gray and interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. All I really need now that that reveal has happened is, since John Watson and Mary Watson apparently are both sharpshooters, for them to need to go in commando style and rescue Sherlock Holmes from something. I don't care where it is. It could be in Serbia, it could be in London.
I would be absolutely all 100% behind that.
Team Watson.
Okay. So we learned that Mary is an ex-CIA assassin, running from her past, and the fact that she lies because she didn't want John to know what she had done in the past. Because, if you're a CIA assassin, you've killed a lot of people. And, you know, people may not like you once they know about that.
That was a total throwaway, though. I mean, I know you're saying, and I agree with you, that they're going to, like, get into it in later episodes. But they're like, FYI, CIA assassin, just take it, just swallow it. There you go.
just have that.
I think it complements the fact, like, the Moran and sharpshooter things. I guess it kind of all goes together.
Yeah.
If you think of it as being the empty house, I agree with you 100%. Like, mm-hmm. if you think of that as being, and I do in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think this series is, like, combined a lot of those books together to create this kind of ongoing, like, empty house, like, narrative through the series.
Then we pretty much jump back to Christmas at the Holmes's. John decides that he doesn't need or want to know about Mary's past. So he throws the thingamajig into the fire.
Now, do we think that he's been living with Sherlock this whole time? It's obviously quite a few months.
Since they're not having conversations, that's not unlikely, first of all. Second of all, because she's really surprised that they're actually talking. So, like, yeah, maybe. That's perfectly valid. Two, in A Study in Pink, Mycroft, at the end of the episode, when he says, oh, you can imagine the Christmas dinners, John's like, no, I really can't. But they gave it to us. They actually did the Christmas dinner. Where you're like, oh, now I can imagine it. You drugged your whole family.
Yeah. It's the bit where they're smoking outside together. That's so funny.
I love it. Oh, yeah.
He's like, Mycroft's like, no. And Sherlock's like, Mycroft is. It's
like that acting in that fireplace scene, though, that... yeah, when he throws the Agra file away. Both Amanda Abington and Martin Freeman, I mean, like, God, stunning. That was just so well done.
Yeah, and I like the fact that, you know, he's forgiven her for now, and he's still like, I'm still very pissed off, and it's going to come out every now and again. So their relationship isn't completely repaired, nor do I think it will likely to be, but I think they did do it in a fairly realistic-ish way, that he's like, I'm still very angry at you, but...
It's not dissimilar from the relationship that he reaches with Sherlock Holmes at the end of The Empty Hearth.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's why, like, I think in a lot of ways that, like, going back to the review that I wrote for the first episode, is that, like, Mary is supposed to be the opposite complement to Sherlock in, like, John's world. You know, they're not the opposite each other. They're, like, the complements that sort of balance the scales of, you know, John Watson being in the middle.
Yeah, he has that moment. He's like, oh, you two should have gotten married. Fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's there to, like, normalize them. Like, to give them access to that world.
Well, and I think the fireplace scene justifies a little bit of the episode jumping there, because it gives us enough time that we can believe that Watson has come to a point of being able to at least partially forgive her without that needing to happen in, like, 2 weeks. And so that I felt like the jump there was emotionally resonant in a way that it wouldn't have been. I still think I'm on the side of thinking there might have been a slightly more flowing way to do it, but I think emotionally it kind of justified that.
Yeah, it was nice. It was like I was watching it with my parents, and it's really funny, like, because my mom gets really into it. And she was just like, but he will forgive her, won't he? Won't he, Catherine? He will forgive her. And I'm just like, just watch it, Mom. It'll be fine.
Catherine's mom is like, she's just an assassin. It's not a big deal.
My mom was very forgiving of Mary, like, very forgiving.
Well, because we don't see any of it, and that's my argument, where it's like, okay, well, no, we don't actually know what you're capable of doing, and I find that really interesting in terms of creating mystery surrounding a major character, that now you can do anything with her, essentially, and that is extremely clever on the part of the show writers. But, you know, I think that for some people it might have lacked a bit of emotional payoff, because you're like, I don't actually know whether this is a person who I should trust or not. All I know is she shot Sherlock Holmes and he died for like 5 minutes.
At the same time, I think it's consistent with John Watson's character that he does not pursue finding out more. So I felt like if they were going to not give it to us, they escaped giving it to us in a way that I felt was character consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay, yes, yeah, so there's the lovely moment after the smoking wherein Mycroft admits that losing Sherlock would break his heart. And you're kind of like, where the hell did this come from? And that's because...
What am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, what the hell am I supposed to say to that? And I think that just comes off of that whole Eastern European thing that he's like, you should reject this. He's like, I reject this. Okay. which, of course, comes to play in later.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the episode is we are given a lot more insight into the relationship between Mycroft and Sherlock. And in that, initially... I think when, like, you start watching it from the first series, you kind of think that Sherlock is a bit of a dick to his older brother, who's kind of like worries about him all the time. But it's kind of flipped over, and it's kind of revealed that actually Mycroft was a massive dick when they were kids. And Sherlock is almost never recovered from that. Like in the depths of his mind where Redbeard still lives.
No.
Yeah. Oh, that was poetic, Catherine.
Yeah, I am a... This late at night, I can be poetic.
Yep. So it turns out that Sherlock has drugged everyone and has made a deal with Magnuson.
Drug all the family.
Just the fact that Billy was there was so hilarious at their Christmas thing.
That was great.
So we are brought to Appledore, which is such a cool looking house, frankly. So we learned that it was Magnuson, as we all thought, that put John in the bonfire. Because he was interested in the food chain of getting up to Mycroft, and he figured out which pressure points applied to each person.
That was killer, and it was also killer that Magnuson has been updated in this screenplay to not necessarily either a Rupert Murdoch or a Ted Turner, but reminiscent of that style of sort of mogul, you know, where it's like, okay, Rupert Murdoch, Ted Turner, all these people, you actually control a lot of media. And if you were in the position to just know things about people, shit can go real south real fast. So I thought that was a super interesting update as far as just ways to extrapolate the canonical character is concerned.
No, definitely. Very resonant.
I might be forgetting the order. Have we talked about the encounter that they had where he... took Magnuson's glasses?
No, yeah,
or
no,
am I getting ahead?
No, we haven't talked about that yet.
I just thought that was a really odd and interesting sequence in a lot of ways, and I think obviously I wanted to mention it because that's the moment where we realized that it's not the glasses, that we might have thought that there was, you know, technology there. Sherlock obviously thought there was technology there, and that's when we first start to get a hint that that Sherlock is having issues with this guy that he doesn't have with anyone, that he's maybe confused and surprised by something. And I feel like any time that happens in a Sherlock Holmes story or in an episode, I go, ooh, you know, I don't like seeing Sherlock Holmes be surprised by something. That's an unsettling thing to have happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, they set that up right at the beginning of the canonical story where Milverton's there And they're like, let's steal the... Oh, never mind. We're not going to steal any letters from you. Watson, you know, does the luchador-style chair for a second, and then nothing really comes of it, and you are deeply uncomfortable and unsettled from then, because you're like, how are we ever going to come back from this? While we're rewinding a tiny bit, I just have to throw out, because I'm kind of obsessed with, like, this theme of just how they've brought Sherlock as a hero back from the dead, how much he's developed, etc. There's this brilliant metaphor in Charles Augustus Milverton where they're talking about the safe, and Watson says, this is the dragon, specifically. Like, this is the dragon in which, you know, so many fair ladies' futures are kept, and we were dragon slayers, essentially, he says, while they're, like, hiding there waiting to combat Milverton and waiting to, you know, get at the safe and get at the actual letters. And then you have that conversation with Mycroft when they're outside pretending not to be smoking, and they are talking about how Sherlock, Mycroft thinks he thinks of himself as a dragon slayer, and says, regarding England, here there be dragons. And I just think that thematically, all of that is really pretty, because, like, they tied it right back to the canonical episode. Yeah. The only bit about it that's slightly disappointing is that in Charles Augustus Milverton, the knights errant who were sent to slay the dragon ended up being totally superfluous, because the lady was like, take that, and that, and that, and that. So, I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of the original story, but
yeah,
the fact that they kept the metaphor, I thought, was, like, really cool.
Cute.
I was thinking the same thing. Like, it was a little disappointing that it wasn't a sort of a mysterious woman that got to finish off Magnuson in the end, and that the heroes were kind of left to just be like, oh, well, that's done then. But it did, it obviously, like, from the way that the script was written, it did make sense, because obviously when Absolutely, we jump forward to that point, because that is Sherlock's last vow, that he would protect them, you know, that he did that.
It also is what they've done repeatedly throughout all three series, which is give us canonical stories and situations, but change around character involvement, which I think is a way of creating suspense for people who think they know how the story is going to end, because you can't ever be sure that they're going to end it exactly the same way. It's like what they did with the Hounds of Baskerville in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think they did honor the fact that it was a woman at the beginning with Mary who was initially going to kill Magnuson. And I think part of the reason also that Sherlock ends up snapping and deciding that he's going to do Magnuson in is, like, one, fulfilling his vow to John and Mary to protect them, and also kind of to finish Mary's work. Mm-hmm. I feel like, because it was kind of his fault that she didn't get to do it in the first place, because he snooped.
Yeah,
that was, like, a no-look basketball pass, like a really cool, like, basketball pass, and then he just, like, finished the layup, you know? Like, it
well,
was,
and that's what,
it was well
it's
done.
Like, the first half hour of the episode was almost, like, basically the straight-up story of Charles Augustus Milverton, and it's almost like we got it didn't end, so we had to have the rest of the episode to finish it a slightly different way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's accurate.
And we hope that this is the last time they've used the high-functioning sociopath line.
Oh, God, please, thank you. Oh. Thank you so much.
Yeah, like, I was surprised.
It's really not true. And for two, like, it was funny the first time, but I think we're kind of done with it now.
Yeah.
It was funny the first time. Like, not the subsequent eight times.
Yeah.
Like, I think the only way that it kind of works in this context is, sorry, I really enjoy playing devil's advocate with all of you, is that I think because he knows what he's about to do is going to get him in a lot of trouble, obviously. And it's sort of, it's almost like him kind of, like, going back against the people, or, like, everyone who's saying, like, he's become too human, or he's become too humanized, that he's like, and it goes back to that whole, like, I may be on the side of the angels, but I'm not one.
That is a really good devil's advocate position, and I completely can see how that would work if that was your interpretation of it. But, in fact, his motivation for doing this is entirely 100% emotionally motivated. So, like, of all places to put that line, like, what he's doing is not motivated by sociopathy in that context at all. You know,
well,
like he's doing it.
And it's also from a story perspective, it is a moment of true heroism and sacrifice.
I wonder if he's
undercut that by having the hero say, oh, I'm not a hero. You are about to do something extremely heroic, so just don't deny it.
I wonder if it's him trying to, like, trick himself into that, because he never wanted to be a hero.
I like that.
But
I think that's the biggest question I've heard people asking, is why that line would have been said right there. And I feel like, I mean, my only way of looking at it is that, much like in the canon, when Holmes and Watson are unreliable narrators about themselves, that it was intentional dramatic irony, but I'm not sure how well that went over by how much discussion there is and how much people don't seem to have grasped the purpose of it right there, although I really, really like Christina's devil's advocate position too.
No, I do. I do too. But additionally, you also have the sort of like the way it's filmed. You've got him haloed. Like he's literally haloed. Like you're being given visual cues that are completely at odds with the things that people are saying.
So I'm going to have a little bit of a devil's advocate moment as well, and it could possibly be as simple as like Sherlock's poor taste humor coming through. Like, we know that from, like, many, like, examples that his humour is incredibly poor taste and comes out at the most inappropriate moments. So there is possibly not a more for him to have a, like, an attack of the incredibly poor humour. But that might be, it might be just as simple as that. Like, his brain was like, well, this is what you're going to say. And he's like, I'm rolling with it.
Oh, man.
These are all possibilities. But the fact of the matter is that he completely snapped, and I think a lot of that was just Magnuson's bullying of John, the flicker face thing. Like, because you start giggling at the beginning because you're like, this is ridiculous. And then you just become more and more uncomfortable the longer it goes on. It was just so, like, I think traumatic's probably too strong of a word, but it was just deeply unsettling to watch that happen, and that John wasn't able to sort of fight back because he was just like, I don't quite know what to do in this situation. And he asks Sherlock for help, and Sherlock is, I think he's, one, incredibly disappointed in himself for missing the mark. Two, he knows he is failing not only John but Mary when he's his vow that he's taking quite seriously. And three, he's probably just trying to figure out what's going to happen next.
And yeah, he seems to be working out what he's going to do as well.
Like, and it slowly dawns on him that he's like, there's only two ways this can go. One, we both go to jail, and that will not, and I don't want that to happen to John, so the other option is for me to take on this horrible other option, which is I kill Magnuson, and therefore all the issues just converge on me.
And also, it kind of is the only realistic solution to get rid of Magnuson as a kind of a problem, really, because, well, I think that's probably the biggest mistake that Magnuson made, is he kept all the information in his head. And then the most obvious thing to do, obviously, is to shoot him in the head. And that kind of problem solved.
Like, it's like his tragic flaw, his fatal flaw, not that he's a tragic hero, obviously, he's a tragic villain, but the fact that he is so sure that he has everybody where he wants them that he literally makes the only solution, the killing him, which means he's going to be a target for the person who finally figures out that that's what has to happen, which happens to be Sherlock Holmes.
Which is, again, a really antithetical sort of note if you're going to compare him to Moriarty, whose worst enemy is himself. Yeah. I mean, like, no one can take out Moriarty. Not even Sherlock Holmes can take out Moriarty. Only Moriarty can take out Moriarty. As far as Magnuson is concerned, he has absolutely turned himself into this, you know, figure that cannot be allowed to live. Moriarty could have kept going for as long as he wanted. He just was taunting Sherlock Holmes because he was bored to tears and suicidal.
No, I think that's a really interesting point, is that Magnuson kind of sealed his own doom by taking all of these safety precautions. He basically, like, led himself to that point.
And what kind of lazy blackmailer does not have some kind of fail-safe of, you know, if something happens to me, all this information will be revealed?
Thank you.
Well, I guess
you.
He was only thinking of himself.
Did he not watch TV at all? I mean...
Has he never read the canon?
Well, it harkens back to the real-life story of Charles Augustus Howell, who was actually murdered by one of his victims, ostensibly. No one ever figured out who killed him, but he was found under mysterious circumstances with a coin in his mouth signifying someone was calling him a slanderer. So, it dovetails with the truth.
Sherlock is now a murderer, and Mycroft ends up bargaining for him not to be imprisoned, making the astute assumption that he would incite a riot in any prison that he would be in, probably because he put the majority of the people in there. He makes a deal with Lady Smallwood to take that Eastern European, job. And it sort of starts the Eastern Wind line, which just sort of like slowly destroys your soul if you know anything about the last, his last bow.
Centenary this year.
Oh, would you look at that?
Really?
Yeah, so the goodbye between Sherlock and John, it's particularly sad because John doesn't know that Sherlock probably isn't coming back.
Which is a reversal of the goodbye in his last bow, because Watson's going back to the front lines.
Yep. Nice little role reversal there. If nice, you mean horrible. And we'll be talking about this later by one of the questions that someone sent in, but we get this little note of William Sherlock Scott Holmes.
Everyone's asking about that. I love how many people are curious.
Yeah. Baring Gold.
I have page 47 of the Baring Gold, which is the biography, the little mini biography that he wrote as an intro to the annotated. And he postulates that Sherlock's first name is either William or Thomas because of the fact that he starts going off and riffing about geography for a bunch of this, and like growing up in Yorkshire and the farmstead has to do with the ridiculous name. Sherlock obviously is his first name. The explanation for Scott, which I actually included in Dust and Shadow, is because he goes by the name of Escott as one of his aliases. So the extrapolation of Scott being the middle name after Sherlock is that if you're calling yourself S. Scott, maybe it was Sherlock initial Scott, and S. Scott was then, an alias that he used more than once. But the plumber named Escott, I think, is actually the one from Milverton, isn't it?
Yes.
Which brings us straight back, because the plumber named Escott, S. Scott Holmes. So the William or Thomas part, there's certainly much less evidence for it. But then we don't even actually really have any reason for thinking he was born on January the 6th. So,
okay, so the backtracking. Sherlock reveals his violin and then says that there's something he needs to say. This may be his last chance. It's up to debate what that was actually going to be. But then he's like, Sherlock's the girl's name, because we learned that John and Mary are having a girl, and that baby's going to be so fucked, but we're not going to think about that.
No. Things that we're not going to think about. That.
Mm-hmm. Also, the moment when he said, I might as well say it now, because I'm never going to see you again. It's like the most painful moment in this entire episode, and... Yeah, I'm not going to say it, but I'm not going to lie to you either. it was not pretty.
It's not pretty at all, and it's so much of their, riff off of bow as opposed to vow. Like, that goodbye is excruciating.
Sherlock gets on a plane, flies off, and you think that's the end. And then we go to the pub with Lestrade.
And 9 million brilliant Greg faces.
Yes. Everyone's reactions were really great. And we see a sort of image of Moriarty. Did you miss me? Did you miss me? Did you miss me? Sherlock is called back. So it was just like this intense emotional roller coaster, which I imagine was quite intentional. Revealed, assumed that Moriarty's back.
Sorry, we had a lovely email from Turk who couldn't be in for this episode, unfortunately, but wanted us to say that she hopes that this is a tie-in to bringing us a real Moran character as opposed to like a sort of pretend throwaway one. Although we have kind of discussed a little bit how Mary does sort of fulfill that role, but I can see how it would maybe bring in a, if it isn't going to be Moriarty, then hopefully it will be somebody, you know, like a Moran style character. But like a lot of people are obviously hoping for that still.
Yeah, like
absolutely. Yeah,
I do not think that Moriarty is back. I think that there's a few theories going around which are very interesting, and one of them is that Moriarty created sort of something to happen in the case of his death, like set off a chain of events sort of thing, which is where I think the Moran thing also can come in, that the person fulfilling his work and is using Moriarty's image to attract attention and chaos and like all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's canonical his siblings come after Sherlock too.
That's the other thing, that Jim Moriarty does have has a brother also named Jim.
Yep.
Because Arthur Conan Doyle.
Arthur Continuity Doyle comes up with two siblings named Sherlock and Mycroft and can't bother to come up with a different name than James.
Moriarty's Jim and his other brother, Jim.
There has been some interesting theories about the brother being a twin as well because of the whole Richard Brooke thing.
I mean, that's the only way that they could bring...
That's one of the crazy theories of canonical scholars as well.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
It's actually not Professor James Moriarty, it's Professor Moriarty, and he's got a brother called James, and that's extrapolated from, I think, Final Problem and Empty House. And there's a whole like long bit in my annotated about it, so I just thought it was nice to kind of reference all that with a throwaway line and go...
We're off on hiatus
for the next 15 years, so you guys just talk amongst yourselves.
Like, the only way I could see them bringing back Andrew Scott is if they did go with the twin brother thing. I'm kind of like, yay, Andrew Scott, but also I'm like, twin brothers.
That's not the only way you could do it, though, because you could bring him back. He lives in Sherlock's Mind Palace, clearly.
That is true.
You could bring him back in any number of sequences along those lines. And what I'm really curious about is, like, now I'm going to be, like, searching the canon for who the heck this is, you know? Because they were talking about how, oh, you know, we did the Moriarty arc, so now we want to do some of the other most amazing villains in the canon. And I got to be honest with you, they knocked it out of the park with Milverton / Magnuson. But otherwise, like, I am totally ready for them to, you know, whip out Grimesby Roylott or, you know, any number of other people. And I'm just curious, like, to whose advantage would it be to bring Moriarty back if it was part of their own personal scheme?
I don't know. But, we have a while to figure it out.
I was just going to say, my sister and I were watching together, and both of us were saying, you know, this was a very epic season. To me, it was like a 3-episode conclusion to the Reichenbach arc. And I'm ready for what I feel like they've set up, which is that Sherlock can go back to using some of his, you know, his deductive skills in a more traditional Sherlock Holmes kind of way.
Mm.
And that's not to say that I didn't like this season, because I absolutely loved it. I thought it was phenomenal in many ways. But I think and hope that, like Lindsay said, I hope this is someone else that will be able to recognize another villain. And I hope it's someone who, you know, Sherlock can kind of get back down to what makes him who he is, and that we'll actually see the detective work as he kind of uncovers what's actually going on with this. And I feel like that's what they're setting up, but we'll have to see, obviously.
We've kind of walked away, like, I'm not sure how I feel about this, but we've walked away from Series 1 being sort of a modern spin on something that was very rooted in the canon, like in its visual style and also in the spirit of it, to it being very much its own thing. I mean, The Sign of Three was a really, really awesome episode and kind of the one that I like most of the series. But it's not really related to the canon stories very much. So, you know, it's kind of walked away into this territory where it's kind of its own thing, and it's a bit unpredictable, even because even after series two, you were like, okay, these are the three stories that they're going to do next, right? Okay, so, you know, these are the canon stories that I'm going to read. Whereas now it's just, yeah, it's kind of sort of inspired by the stories kind of loosely and by the characters, but it's very much in the space where it's now completely its own thing.
Artie, I actually agree with you, except for that Melinda pointed out when we were podcasting last time that Sign 3 is actually Silver Blaze. And my mind was blown. I was like, oh, it is, 100%.
Yeah.
Because, like, if there's the rehearsal stabbing.
Yeah, she said that on the radio episode as well, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I didn't get it till then, but I agree with you that it's sort of, you know, like, wandering a bit. And, like, that's why I actually liked the last episode, his last vow, so much, was because they took so much directly from Milverton. And I felt like even though there was a lot of it that was still very, we're solving John and Mary's marriage, we're, you know, like continuing to develop Sherlock's character as a semi-tragic hero figure who doesn't exactly think that he is one. Despite all of that, I did like how much they harked back to that case, you know? So I would be hopeful, I think, as you are, that they would find more cases where they could do that in the next series.
So Vexica on Tumblr asks, we all know what happened to the other one. What's Mycroft talking about?
In Baringold, Sherlock and Mycroft have a brother. He is an older brother, correct me if I'm wrong. His name is Sharonford, keeping the family tradition of bizarre names going. And he is not canonical for anyone who might be confused by that.
So Seduce My Mind, You Idiot, on Tumblr.
Excellent name.
Yeah. I'd like some discussion of that John is one of Sherlock's pressure points, but Sherlock isn't one of John's. I think this is very easily answered, the fact that Magnuson is a rememberer, not a deducer.
Yeah, he got it wrong.
Yeah.
He remembers things. And as far as, like, he was concerned, like, as I talked about, he's interested in the food chain to get to Mycroft. So even if he had cataloged that Sherlock Holmes was a pressure point to John Watson, it wouldn't have gotten him closer to Mycroft anyway, so he didn't care.
No, it would be lateral. The move would be lateral, not, yeah, you know, right, like vertical. So whatever.
Good.
Yeah.
He doesn't
good
care. Point. In the context of the episode, are you going to listen to Sherlock Holmes, who kind of knows everything, or are you going to listen to Magnuson, who is clearly just the most screwed up individual rememberer of all time? Because even Sherlock in his mind palace knows John would cry buckets. I'm worried about John. Like, obviously, that's a pressure point. It's not, you know, it's not an issue. It's just not listed.
Okay, so we have one from Hey Manticone. I think I wrote that right. And this is actually something that's been asked a few times. So I'll mention what you guys have to say about it. Talking about John's total failure to react to Sherlock's sacrifices, the jump from the Sign of Three to his last vow.
I don't know that I'm going to go on and on about directing of this episode, but it doesn't all come down to screenwriting sometimes. You don't know. Obviously, there's a conversation that is skipped, and it's a major conversation. So what was said during that prior conversation? Who has any idea? But that's a character moment I would have liked to have happened, but I don't know the direct route to solve it.
Well, you could extrapolate from that there had been conversations between John and Sherlock in the intermediate when John wasn't speaking to Mary as well, but obviously we didn't, because of time constraints for the episode, didn't get to see any of that either. So there probably were a lot of conversations that just for...
Because it's funny, of the way it's like, that, it's,
yeah.
the viewers, like, they want all this emotional payoff, and then when there's too much emotional payoff, they're like, well, where'd the case go? And you're like, look, well, we have 90 minutes.
No, it's just, I was talking to Tasty Tricks on Twitter about the circularity of this, the fact that Sherlock is doing for John in the end of this episode what John did for him at the end of A Study in Pink.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm going to be just perfectly honest and say that that was not a moment that I missed, because to me, these are two people who have a relationship that that kind of stuff almost goes without saying. And I'm not saying I wouldn't have been happy to see it, but I feel like, just like after A Study in Pink, we didn't see a huge amount of... It was like, what you've done is... The magnitude of what you've done is so amazing that there's no way I could quantify it in words.
No, and they just buy Chinese food for each other.
And exactly. And I feel like that was the same thing that Martin was conveying at the end at the airport, was... my respect for you is my thanks. The fact that you are now cemented as the best person that I've ever known. And I guess for me, I bought into the portrayals. I felt like it was there, kind of underneath the surface, even though we never had that actual, break it down conversation.
It was explicit in previous episodes though. So it's like, it's covered.
That I have as well. Yeah. Because in Sign of Three, you know, they are both very vocal about how they feel about each other. And it's in Series 2, there's a similar thing between the second and the third episode of their emotional relationship to each other, you know, that should have been affected by scandal, but isn't, which is solved, obviously, if you have a theory that Hounds actually happens during scandal, you know.
When they're saying goodbye, John is lost for words in a way, so I kind of maybe feel that that was sort of just them. I think maybe it's easier to express your adoration of someone when there's a bunch of people. It's pretty much just a giant love fest, as which weddings are. But when you're, like, face-to-face with that person, maybe then it's like, oh, well, you know, we can, okay.
It's like what Lindsay said last time, you know, like, they're her dudes. they're not going to be that, like, mushy with each other, really.
What are you expecting?
You have to remember...
Oh,
like,
I can tell you what I was expecting.
Well, already. I mean, not yes, but... This is the same dude who... He thought Sherlock Holmes was dead and gives this extraordinarily reserved, you know, acting performance at the gravesite. Don't be dead. That's just something that I'd like you to do for me, please. Is that something you could see your way to doing? And then, you know, like, they really covered it in the first two episodes of this season. So for people to be expecting some sort of, I don't know, extraordinary revelation in the plane scene, it's kind of like,
British people don't have those kind of feelings. Just, you have to accept them.
But it's, I feel like it's a respect too. It's like at the very beginning in A Study in Pink, Sherlock Holmes respects John Watson's choice to save his life. And I feel like at the end of this episode, John Watson respects Sherlock Holmes's choice to protect him. It's like saying, you made a vow and you kept it. And I feel like, when you have situations with two dudes, as you guys were saying, to me, the respect that you see there is as important as any kind of emotional outpouring, just for me personally.
No, I think that's absolutely true, Amy.
Okay. And to end off, this is sort of like two people kind of asked this that I have written down. Wasting Your Gum on Twitter, and mher1979 on Twitter also, pretty much saying, like, how do we feel about Sherlock being a murderer? The fact that they are standing around a body and Sherlock Holmes put it there.
Oh yeah, I love that prophecy come true.
Mm-hmm. Does Holmes kill anyone in the canon?
Sure. Yeah, not... I mean, well, you don't actually know who kills Tonga, but either Holmes or Watson does. Because they're both shooting. Am I right? In Sign of Four?
Yeah.
Kills Moriarty as well. Kills,
this is
throws
true.
Him off a waterfall.
Yeah,
true. Yeah, he kills people when he needs to.
I was going to say, it's almost like the last resort as well. Like, he didn't intend to kill Moriarty, but, you know, potentially would he have done had he thought that... Because he was threatening John... And that, and if he thought that that was the only solution, like the absolutely only thing that he could have done to save him, then would he have killed Moriarty? And obviously, in this situation, he was driven, by Magnuson himself. The only solution was that the only way he'd get rid of all that threat was just to get rid of him, just to end
That's
him.
That's pretty interesting, because it's interesting that in this, you know, BBC Sherlock universe, Sherlock Holmes doesn't kill Moriarty, but I'm completely fine with him murdering Magnuson, because he does kill Moriarty in the canon. So it's like...
Well, and not to keep harping on the first episode, but again, if we're okay with John Watson shooting somebody through a window because are threatening Sherlock Holmes in a way that appeals to his greatest weakness, essentially, that's exactly what Magnuson is doing to John. And it's even worse in a way, because there's no way justice is ever going to touch Magnuson. That's the thing to me. You're in a situation where this man is basically responsible for probably thousands of deaths, even if he didn't pull the trigger, and no one's ever going to touch him. And I think that's the dilemma that we see Mycroft in through the episode. And it's like, unless someone does this, this man is never going to be stopped. And so I think if we're okay with what John does in Study in Pink, it's very much a parallel to the same thing.
That is very true. Alrighty.
All right, lovely ladies.
Alrighty.
All right.
Yeah, good talks.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?